Good evening. This is Izzy Borshoff and you're listening to 91.5 FM. This is WMFO Medford or Tufts Freeform Radio. This is our very first episode of a new show called In Your 20s. The idea is that every second Tuesday night I'm going to have someone in here to talk about a different facet of life in your 20s. So that might be a kind of work, it might be religion, it might be dating. And tonight for our first show, we've got Drew Edwards in. He is both my roommate and also he's here to speak about leadership in your 20s. So Drew has a pretty interesting story and I want to leave most of it for him to tell. So we might kick off with a bit of a brief introduction and maybe Drew just fill us in on how you found yourself age 19 running your own organization in Uganda.
Yeah. Well, we're filling big shoes. I feel like that it's such a an auspicious title, leadership in your 20s. That implies that I've done something, but I guess we have a little bit of experience, and it'd be cool to fill in the background of that, like you said. And I feel like it starts with not meaning to get in that place. And that, for me, started like at least a year before that, going into college, like all of us, and you're not sure exactly where you want to go, if you're making the right decision, what your major is going to be, because everyone wants to know what that is, whether it's your parents or just getting on campus and that's like the intro question, like, what's your name, what's your major, where do you live?
It's like as if anyone ever made a friend based on what their projected major was going to be.
And that you ever actually stuck with the first major, right? So, I went to orientation. I was going to go to the University of Toledo. I really wanted to be a teacher. The only thing I cared about at the age of 18 was running track in college, and I was going to run there. And I remember getting to orientation and hating it. I mean, just hating the state of Ohio, hating everybody that I met. Maybe I was just in a bad mood that day. But like any well-thought 18-year-old, I made a impulsive decision and dropped out. And went home, and my parents were like, hey, so how was orientation? They were really stoked. We had like our graduation party 2 weeks prior. And I was like, all right, so don't freak out. I dropped out. And they did freak out. And all of a sudden it turned into this like, oh, but what are you going to do now? What's next? And for me, for a lot of reasons, it just seemed like it made a lot of sense not to spend this crazy amount of money that we're all falling into debt doing at the time and do something a little bit different. And for me, that was kind of service-based stuff. So I ended up doing a program where I got placed in Uganda. And after doing that, working in a refugee camp and watching kind of the repatriation process where people started going home after the war and asking what was next, a couple of friends and I there, and once I started going to undergrad at DePaul in Chicago, had met, and they'd also been to Uganda. We decided to do something about it and eventually start an organization. That's kind of the really accelerated background of how we got to what's been happening the last 8 years.
So you were working in a refugee camp in Uganda, mm-hmm. as part of your gap year, and then you came back to Chicago and met a bunch of other people who'd done similar things or were also interested in Uganda.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And then this is kind of a question I'm interested in, and maybe you can give a bit of background on exactly what the organization was doing, but mm-hmm. I think I alluded to this in some of our earlier conversations. I feel like at school I was very much taught to kind of follow the rules and do the best I could, and potentially one day I might have a qualification and a job and some experience that would enable me to make a difference. But I certainly didn't kind of go through my formative teenage years or even my early adulthood thinking kind of on a daily basis, wow, this is not done very well. I'm the one to fix it. So you're 19, you're in this country that you really don't know very well. I mean, I'm presuming that much. What kind of gave you the confidence to think, here's a problem? Well, maybe elaborate on the problem for us, but what kind of gave you the confidence to think you were the one to fix it?
I think arrogance is what underpins that. confidence has a couple components, right? Like, I think confidence without humility is arrogance. And I think I was a little bit arrogant. There was not the humility, but also probably the constructive dissatisfaction with the status quo that we had seen around there, right? So, one, we know that money was running out. Aid isn't sexy when there's not a war going on. So that was a factual basis. The other side was, we saw the solutions that were being implemented, and there just wasn't enough money. There weren't enough people. And it was something as simple as like, well, I could do something about this. Why don't we do something about this? And it wasn't like, let's start an organization. It was, hey, I've got some friends that have this problem. Like, it'd only be like a few thousand dollars if we ran this project. They'd be able to take care of it themselves. And that was like initially the goal. And that's, I feel like that's what gave us the confidence. But all of a sudden you learn a lot more in the process that makes you realize more people probably need this service, but that also, you probably need to like make this a little more official, because otherwise it's like, so why is this 18-year-old or 19-year-old like taking money from us to bring somewhere else?
Yeah, got it. So can you maybe talk us through recognizing what the problem was and kind of what the first thing you actually did was? Like, did you open a spreadsheet and start making a budget, or did you go knock on some doors? How did you kind of get the whole thing off the ground?
Well, the problem is complex. I mean, the problem, if anyone knows about the Millennium Development Goals, there were this big 15-year international kind of unilateral goals where we said, we're going to try to solve some of the world's biggest problems. And at the time, this was 2008, at the time, people were really focused in the education sector on building schools, access. That was the big thing. And we thought we were being really innovative by focusing on sustaining schools. So we'd seen a lot of schools that were built and other schools that were being built without really the question of how are we going to run these things in perpetuity? Our answer was just like, how do we financially sustain them? So we were helping structure schools' finances. We were helping create income. And I think, you know, our biggest success cases were schools that had been generating 60% more income through projects that we were doing. And that was really great. And we did that for, I don't know, for 5 years.
And can I just interrupt there? So you're kind of a couple of 19-year-olds, or maybe some of you are a bit older, and you're like, cool, we're going to help schools financially restructure. At this point, you've been at college for like maybe 1 year. Did you have previous experience in that? What was like literally the first thing you did? Yeah.
Literally, we went to a Barnes & Noble and we bought, each three of us that had co-founded it bought a book. I bought Nonprofits for Dummies, like literally that book. And I don't know, we figured like we should probably do this the right way, whatever that is. And we didn't have experience in that stuff. I think what's interesting about it, and I think what is an interesting driver for anybody that does anything interesting in their career or elsewhere that are really trying to solve problems, is like you see the problem and you say, this can't be that complicated. We should try to fix it. So yeah, we just like pulled out like spreadsheets and figured out how to do accounting, and which again is a little arrogant in retrospect, but also the more that I know about accounting and financial structuring now, it doesn't have to be that complicated. So I don't know, we just sat down and figured it out with people.
And then persuading other people that you were legit. How did you go about that?
A sexy website?
Nice. Okay. So like WordPress, or what was it back then? Tumblr? Yeah. I don't know.
It was probably Tumblr back then. It was definitely a like template site or something. I mean, the biggest thing, yeah, is validity, and it continues to be a problem, and it was a problem. At the time, I think one of the biggest challenges that we were experiencing was, when you go and you ask for money from all these different people, what ends up kind of happening, and they're like, well, why should I give it to an 18-year-old? It was this kind of establishing that we knew what we were talking about, or that we could track where the money was going to go ultimately.
Yeah, okay. So just kind of like being as professional as you could, given the fact that you were 19 years old. This is quite interesting. We now have some vacuum cleaners joining us.
I hear that makes that quite loud on the radio, I guess.
Oh, well, we'll stay close to our mics and just press on, I guess. So I kind of wanted to talk to you a little bit about your relationship with Africa and being 19. And was it your first time there?
Yeah, it was my first time, yeah.
And whether you felt any qualms about what you were trying to do there. And in terms of it's a complicated history, and there's kind of a lot of baggage associated with kind of white saviorism in Africa. And how did you kind of navigate that, or did you consciously navigate that as a pretty young person trying to do something that would have real impact there?
Yeah, I mean, I think, let's be honest, I mean, we didn't do it particularly well at first, I don't think. You know, I think for a lot of us, the impetus to help is enough at first, and I think you just hope that you stumble across really good guidance. And I think we did. And what ended up kind of happening is I think we probably made mistakes. I don't know that I know all of the mistakes that we made, but
sure.
I think over time, like, you kind of iterate and you try to get better at it as you go. And honestly, I think we learn most from other people making mistakes athletes publicly. Right. So do you remember like the Coney 2012
thing? Of course. Paint the night red.
Paint the night red. Right. And, you know, subsequently, it was like this 3 or 4 day blow up of like the international community all of a sudden caring about the community and the issue that we were paying attention through this bigger organization, which we don't have to name. And all of a sudden, it all came crashing down. Their founder had this blow up about all the criticisms they were receiving, and the criticisms were all well founded, right? So I think some of the answers and some of the things that we've continued to think about were, you know, the questions were about financial accountability. They were about like the viability and the research basis of the model that they were proposing. What are the implications and what are the voice of the people that you're working with? And were they the ones that were constructing, you know, these ideas or these solutions? Or were you constructing them yourselves? And how is that very much different? I mean, is it kind of neocolonial? Is it different than what's been happening to Africa, things happening to it rather than what's been happening in it from the grassroots before then? And those were, I mean, we could talk about this for a long time, but those were the considerations.
Sure. Yeah, I understand. It kind of takes me back to, I must have been about maybe 14, and I was on a plane to Thailand because, I don't know, Thailand's one of the closest places you can visit when you live in the backwaters of Western Australia. And there was a big school group on the plane, and they must have been roughly my age. And I bumped into one of the girls as I was heading down to the bathroom, and I said, "What are you guys doing here?" And she was like, "Oh, we've actually just been in Cambodia, you know, just helping out." As if like 30, 14-year-old girls were just like lending a casual hand. And I think there's always like a balance between that dynamic and doing something with meaningful impact. But it sounds like your focus on sustainability and trying to really like leverage gains from the work that people had already done was kind of a big part of how you tackled that.
Right, and different. I mean, I think like for the projects that we were implementing, we were kind of running like a micro-lending kind of model. So people were running businesses at these schools. That was a lot of the work, like 75% of it. And for any business to work, I think anybody that's studied it or anyone that's been a funder or watched a Shark Tank knows that you have to have people that are 1,000% invested in the idea. And it has to come from people themselves. It can't just be, you can't just plant and give someone a business. It just doesn't typically hand over well like that. So for us, I mean, it was involving the communities we were working in throughout the process. And the idea, even the idea of starting it, came from our friends in Uganda. I think we had the ambition, and I think we were looking for that opportunity to help in a way that we could. But because it was so locally led for a long time, and when we started, we had a Ugandan board and a U.S. board, right? So there was kind of equal voice in what was going on. Not equal in terms of where the money was coming from, and sometimes you have more like leverage with kind of deciding what you're going to invest in there. But I think we got better at that over time, and our models changed over time as well.
Yeah, right. And so you had a Ugandan board, you had a US board, and then so was it from the beginning that you were kind of running this organization by distance from the US while you're at college and then coming to Uganda in the holidays, or were you there for longer term stints, and how did that kind of play into your ability to lead and make connections and get things off the ground?
Right. I mean, well, let's go back to 18-year-old Drew, right? It's like, yeah. In Uganda, decides like, what am I going to do next? And the decision was like, maybe this was half of the desire to continue to run track in college, but it was, you know, I do want to go and I want to run. I also realized that it's hard to be respected, to have any form of validity, whether it's from government agents or for future employers or from communities we work with, without having a credential, without having gone to university. Otherwise, it's, you know, who are you to do any of this? So I did go back to school, and we started this while I was in school. So it ended up being like probably 2 or 3 months every summer. And then we tried to get out there for probably 3 to 4 weeks every winter. We had this really long break at DePaul. And I did that throughout 4 years of undergrad before moving out there.
And then at what period did the organization kind of grow to the size it is now? And maybe you can talk a bit about the structure of what it's like now and how it grew to that.
Yeah, I mean, things have changed. We've changed. It's been, you know, I think after the first 5 years of running this, you know, after I graduated, I moved out there. I wanted to live out there. And my goal was to kind of really establish our Ugandan leadership and staff so it's truly Ugandan led. And that, you know, we really feel like there's a solid organizational structure, because not a lot of people do that really well. So we went out there, you know, it's just grew a really long beard and long hair and did my thing. After a while, we, as long as the rest of the world, kind of realized that just building schools isn't enough. And there are other issues that fundamentally underpin them. And they're complex. I mean, you have to account for everything, you know, from poverty all the way through to the quality of instruction and everything in between. So we think we narrowed down what the issue was, and we really think literacy underpins this, whether that's quality of instruction or really where the difference is made, which is parent literacy at home. And we've just found there's a huge deficit of materials and programming for that area. So we kind of pivoted and started to focus on that, and that's changed everything. So now we kind of do three big things. Nothing to do with finances, thank God, because I'm not good at that.
Yeah, right. So, and now you have 12 full-time staff, 14?
14 full-time staff, 12 part-time.
12 part-time. And what did that look like in the early days? So how long before you hired staff?
So right when I moved out there, we hired one staff member and another U.S. person that came with me. And it took like a year, honestly, until we hired anybody else.
And where did you get the money for those first staff members?
It was grassroots fundraising. So, we held our first gala. Still going. We just had our fourth gala. It was very exciting. we have a lot of individual donations. I mean, a couple grants. We got some corporate sponsorships, but we weren't working with a lot of money. We were working on like a budget at first of, I don't know, $40,000, $50,000 a year. So it wasn't a significant amount.
And did you hire someone local or...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, hiring local, everything. I mean, everything's also cheaper out there, so it makes it more cost effective as well. But we spent a long time trying to find the right leader that we would build everyone else off of. So the character and the person that we'd collaborate with, who was also, I mean, had some experience, but was also innovative enough to kind of do something different than the status quo.
Yeah, that's kind of an interesting point, which I want to dig into a little bit further around this leadership question, and then also how you sort of build capacity in an organization that really is driven by like the vision of a founder or a pair of co-founders.
Yeah.
But before we kind of get into that, so you're still like 18, 19 at this point. You've hired a staff member who's presumably older than you. You soon hire some more. You maybe have interns from the States.
Yeah. And everyone was just older.
They're all older. So, like, how do you navigate that as a young person? Because I feel like that kind of translates into a bunch of different industries. Like, it was a constant struggle for me in a completely different workplace of trying to have impact and influence when you just don't have... You might have ideas, but you don't have the experience or the positional authority that comes with being over 35.
Right.
So, yeah, talk a little bit about how you navigated that.
Yeah, I mean, at first, again, that arrogance carried a long way, right? It's like, this can't be that hard, and it is. I mean,
was this part of the reason for growing the beard?
Yeah, this part... Actually, it is. That's a good story. I mean, in Uganda, when I had moved there, I had a lot of problem with getting and receiving kind of validity. We had ideas that had won awards when I was in college. We had been on NPR at the time, and there people were getting recognition, a lot of articles written about us. We were doing something right, and the data said so. Even still, you'd have government officials that would look at me and say, who is this young man? and like, maybe not like completely disregard me, but they weren't taking what we were saying seriously. They weren't looking at us as a big player. And part of, especially in the Muslim parts of Uganda, facial hair is associated with this kind of social hierarchy and recognition. So I did start growing a beard for that reason.
Do you think it would have been difficult for a woman in your position or a young woman in your position?
Absolutely. I mean, I even women that have been in our organization on our board that have they're higher in our hierarchy than me are not respected as much as I am. And you have to remember, we're in a pretty patriarchal society still.
Right.
To this day. And because of that, we're trying, even with our current Ugandan staff, you know, we're trying to, I'd like to see women in director positions as much as possible. And our staff's about 50-50 right now. You know, I think we're going to continue to push that. We always look for the best person first, but any chance that we can kind of change and try to empower and turn that narrative, I think is a huge, huge thing.
Yeah, great. And it seems like obviously the organization's grown a lot since then, and it's by all counts been very successful, and I think that's probably in large part due to your leadership and your team. Have you reflected a lot on that aspect of how you run the organization, or do you find that it's something that comes quite naturally and you just kind of roll with it and it's worked out?
There's one part that comes naturally. I'll tell you about that. The rest of them are problems. Are they been learned?
Right? Sure, let's talk through them.
I mean, the first one is that I think when you're passionate about something, that's what attracts people. I mean, people are attracted to, and we've seen this with people like the Simon Sinek's of the world and all the world's books about innovation and what attracts people to leaders. The why matters a lot, right? If you can't articulate the problem and why it matters, the so what factor, people don't want to be involved. And to be honest, anybody listening, have you ever even thought about Uganda in the last 5 years? Probably not. I mean, like, I hadn't before that. I didn't even know where it was on the map. So part of it is, I think, having a compelling narrative, and you don't have to create it. I think it comes from a genuine place, and you either have it or you don't. And that's what drives people to kind of want to be attracted. But I also think, you know, something that we had to learn in the process, and we'll get into some of the deficits, were things like humility, right? I mean, part of it is you have this really interesting idea. You have folks that really care about it in a place like Uganda. You're trying to attract interns as you're a freshman and sophomore in college, and they're like juniors and seniors, right? What the hell is this guy? And, you know, one of the things that we, I guess, tried to work through was, how are we humble enough to know that we're trying to solve a problem, and can we recognize when we don't know the answer to something? But ultimately, a leader has to be the one to make the decision on how we're going to move forward. Otherwise, when you let people kind of take the reins of things, they'll take it any direction that they want to. And I think that was probably the big first kind of lesson.
Yeah, right. And who would you turn to when you realize you didn't know the answer? I assume it depends on the question, but did you have a mentor throughout all of this that you kind of bounced ideas off, or was it just ad hoc?
Yeah, I mean, I was really fortunate to have a mentor that's still my mentor today. And she's now on our board. She was a professor of nonprofit management at the time that I was taking a class with. And I think she kind of like... planted the idea in my mind that I might need a mentor, because she talked about how important it was, where if you see somebody who really knows something about the industry that you're in or that's doing life in a way that's interesting to you, try to connect with them. Try to see if they'd be willing to mentor you in the time. And I was like, oh, you know, like, would you be willing to do that? and I think that maybe she was leading that on. Maybe she wasn't. Maybe I wasn't more creative than that. But, you know, my professor at the time is still my mentor today. And it's just as a person. I mean, part of it is, sure, the technical knowledge matters at times. But more than anything, it's people that have been in leadership positions that know how to manage and talk to people. I mean, because leading is more a cultural, I think, phenomenon, and it's different. I mean, there's different characteristics of leadership in different cultures, and we've had to figure that out as we work with a cross-cultural staff both ways.
Right, right. And do you grapple with your role as like the leader and the visionary of the organization versus the long-term sustainability of it, if you kind of ever decide that you need to do something else? Or is that something you've kind of thought about along the way, or is it very much like your project?
Oh man, we all struggle with it, right? I mean, I don't know about you, I think of like a different career I could have any other day.
Yeah, sure.
I'm really passionate about this. Do we want to see this take off? Yes. The other side of it though was, I mean, I wasn't making any money, right? I don't know about you, but in this country, I had student loans, right? Like, and that those were looming. I sold my car, and that would pay them off for 2 years. But I was ending 2 years, and it was like, well, what do I do? And I hadn't worked for anybody else. I mean, part of it is also like, maybe I need to learn from other people. And that was true. So I ended up taking a sabbatical. I worked for an organization in the UK for a year, doing similar work in Uganda and Nigeria. And I learned a lot from that organization. And I think that reflection was really, really important, because it's completely changed how I focus and how I lead in our organization now.
And how was a transition from being your own boss to presumably at this organization working for someone else? And did that give you pause for reflection on leadership styles? I'm not asking you to throw any form of bosses under the bus here, but was that a useful reflecting kind of experience?
Yeah, I mean, most of the things I learned from my boss there were positive, right? And I was in a weird position. I probably shouldn't at that age have had the responsibility I had. I was like a director of their largest program. So, I mean, I still had probably the same number of staff I have now under me then. So
right.
It was a step up in terms of employees, but I had the guidance of somebody else who had been in this industry for a long time. And something that I learned from her, I mean, it's hard to say. How many things do you learn from one person, right? Like, from a good boss, a lot. I'd learned how to speak to people, how to fundraise. I mean, really how to communicate and how to navigate this industry, how to reckon with some of the bigger, more ethical questions, right? When you're signing a contract and there's a no bribery policy, do you participate in that or not, and why, and what's your stance on that? I mean, there were so many of these larger things that I've never had to encounter before that, you know, ultimately I ended up bringing back and returning to our organization to use because it was just it's a good fit for me.
But yeah, great. I think those kinds of different experiences are always useful. We might take a short music break now, and then I'm going to sort of induct Drew into the community radio tradition / requirement of reading a public service announcement. And then when we come back, we might sort of wind back to a bit of a discussion around idea development and kind of entrepreneurship and leadership more generally. So here we go with some Maggie Rogers.
Oh, love that.
Would you believe me now if I told you I got caught up in a wave? Almost gave it away. Would you hear me out if I told you I was terrified for days? Thought I was gonna break. Oh, I couldn't stop it, tried to slow it all down. Crying in the bathroom, had to figure it out with everyone.
And we're back. Drew, the PSA.
Doorknobs, restrooms, telephones, keyboards, other people. What do these things have in common? They're all easy ways for you to pick up or pass along germs. Germs that could lead to colds and flu. Now, you can't spend days avoiding contact with everything, but you can take a few important steps to protect yourself. Washing your hands is one of the best and easiest ways to avoid catching or spreading colds and flu. Keep your hands and the surfaces you touch clean protects not only you, but it protects those around you. A few extra minutes a day is all it takes to protect your health first. For more on avoiding the flu, talk to your doctor or visit massmed.org. That's MASSMED.org and click Your Health First. This public message is brought to you by the Massachusetts Medical Society.
Thank you, Drew. We'll be sure to wash our hands on the way out.
It's timely. There's a flu going around.
Yeah, exactly. It's important at this time of year. All right, let's get back into it. I kind of want to loop back to the initial motivation question and that why me, why am I the one to have this impact question, but sort of from the other side. Would you say this was a project born out of a particular passion or conviction that this was something you had to do? Or are you sort of an ideas person generally? Like, did you grow up with constant ideas for things you wanted to do? Maybe you were like that kid with a lemonade stall every second day. I don't know.
I mean, I did have a killer lemonade stand.
I'm sure you did. Did you make it yourself?
I did. Well, I think I just dragged a table outside. It was probably not
very
impressive.
Yeah. It's probably like the low cost, high value option there.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that didn't take off, so I thought I'd do something different. And, you know, tried the lawn mowing thing, didn't go well either. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think there's a particular amount of conviction. I think with exposure, sometimes we get convicted and we get entranced by things that we say, I can't believe that this is happening in the world. And I had no idea. I mean, that first trip for me was just about shattering my worldview. Like, I really thought it was like, hell, you know, let's go help some people. And, you know, I'll go learn. And I think I knew I learned most through the world by doing that. During high school, my church we'd all gone down to New Orleans and the southern parts of Mississippi after Hurricane Katrina, and really encountering and understanding how the world worked through that. I mean, it was the biggest learning experience I've ever had, right? You understand insurance doesn't cover every type of tragedy in your life, right? Like,
right.
All of a sudden, most people weren't covered by these issues. And you encounter humanity and the injustice of it and the structures that are supposed to support it in a really real way. And there was something to me that thought I might learn more about that when I went out there. So in some ways, you know, I think I was thinking that I would find that, but you know, I got placed in Uganda. I didn't like go and choose Uganda on a map and say, let's go there. And I think whatever I had seen at that point, right, I mean, Uganda at the time, you had 3 million people that were displaced by the civil war for a 26-year period. You had a lot of youth combatants. At the time, I was volunteering for a youth rehabilitation program for former combatants, so kids that had been involved actively in the war that were under the age of 15. And their reintegration, their cultural and social reintegration into the community that they were from. And I was just doing track. I was doing nothing particularly meaningful. I was like a coach there. But observing and watching that and seeing, you know, what something like an education meant for somebody that now that a war is over, they can choose to do what's next, was a big deal. You know, it's kind of like I just assumed at the time, you know, I asked a question to everybody when they were returning home, and it was, so what are you going to do next? I just assumed everyone has this, like, if the war ends, I'm going to go start a lemonade stand. You know, like,
right.
Whatever those things are. And it, the answer was consistent. And there's a word in Acholi called puanjor, which means to learn. It also means to teach. And everybody had that same answer. And for a lot of elders especially, they were saying, our kids actually never even learned any of the subsistence farming that we'd sustained ourselves on for a very long time. We hadn't been able to pass down a lot of aspects of our culture. Most of us haven't had to work in 26 years. I mean, there's a lot of teaching that needs to go on there, and there's also a lot of learning that needs to happen. And I think the elder people that were really leading communities knew the deficit that their kids and their families were going to have to overcome, and everything centered around school, which is why we wanted to focus on it.
Right. So I'm kind of getting from just the way you're talking to me, and you're very impassioned at the moment, that this is, no, don't apologize. This is great. That this was a project born out of a real sense of kind of social justice and a drive for a better future rather than a kind of entrepreneurial venture for you. I like ideas, I like starting businesses or organizations, and like, here's a problem and I can do something about it and then I'll jump to the next one.
Right, those were not my people.
Right, okay. And do you think that's changed at all? Like, have you reflected on, right, I've really enjoyed the challenge of this, and maybe I'm not kind of preempting you leaving or staying or doing anything, but do you think that's shifted at all? And you're like, this was actually a challenge in and of itself, and I'd like to do it in some other capacity.
I mean, at the time, I thought that stuff sucked. I mean, I really thought it was boring, right? It was like,
right.
I set up a 501c3 organization, and how do you
right.
like balance your accounts, and how do you, you know, I mean, all that. I thought that was all pretty boring. And now I've come to learn, you know, it's really quite important, but also that in a lot of different industries, there's interesting things that people are doing that are kind of fun to either emulate or follow or want to be a part of. And there's other areas where people just don't have solutions for things. And you really think, well, we could probably do that because it's the same learning experience. Let's take a deep dive and really understand the problem. I just haven't found, I mean, we're still working on this problem. So I haven't found that. And I don't know what that'll mean for our career going forward. But right now, this is where we're staying.
This is your thing, yeah. And do you think this is something that we should be trying to teach? I'm kind of getting quite philosophical here now, but do you think this is something that we should be trying to teach more broadly to kids in American schools or in schools elsewhere in the world? Or do you think it's something that you do just learn by doing? Or can you teach a spirit that maybe encourages people to do it?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a couple questions kind of embedded in that.
Yeah.
Let me predicate it by saying I'm a student at the Graduate School of Education here at Harvard, and we're studying a lot of these questions. And while we're still running this thing full time, and I've thought about this both with the context of Ugandan students, but also with U.S. students, right? I mean, I remember being just bored out of my mind when I was in high school because things weren't that interesting. They didn't feel real, and it wasn't because I didn't have access to an excellent education, but that wasn't my preoccupation at the time. The only thing I cared about was running track. For whatever reason, that was important. For kids in Uganda as well, the only thing that they care about is passing a test at a high level. Now, that has high economic stakes and probably a deeper meaning of what's going on there. But I think both of them teach our kids at a deficit. I mean, I think the most important driver, we know this, most data, and it's complex, but most data indicates that curiosity is the best driver of learning. Having said that, curiosity with the assumption that you have access to the materials that you need, the support that you need to pursue it. I think that this idea of problem solving should be at the center of all of our learning. And in fact, for us, that's at the center of our definition of learning. It's not of reading or literacy. You know, the UN definition is different than ours. And I'll delineate those without at the stake of possibly losing you and boring you. But the first part, UN defines it as a person's ability to be able to read and write a single sentence about themselves. That's it. That's a pretty low standard. One, you know, we rewrote that because we felt, and a lot of people have done this, that there needs to be a higher standard in general, but it needs to be inclusive of what learning really is. So ours is, yeah, sure, the ability to be able to read and write a single sentence in order to solve a problem. And that's important, that in order to solve a problem is what drives most people to do, I think, things that are interesting. And also to learn, you know, I've learned more about publishing and the new work that we're doing now. And paper and printing, and I would never have an interest in that prior, but all of a sudden it's become relevant to the work that we do.
And so, just to kind of be a little bit of a devil's advocate here,
yeah.
All of those things that you've just outlined sound like they're pretty big problems right across the US. Like, there's enormous educational disadvantage here, and as we've kind of discussed previously, funding for public schools is so dependent on, like, really localized, I think it's property taxes, is it?
Yeah, so
do you ever feel like, wow, what am I doing in Uganda? There's so much I need to be doing here, or do you sort of view that problem differently?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I've been a part of a lot of these debates. I mean, every time we've ever spoken, people ask, you know, like, hey, we have a huge murder rate here in Chicago. We have a huge education deficits here in Chicago. Why aren't you helping here? I mean, and the truth is, even throughout undergrad, I was tutoring in Chicago the entire time, like every 3 days a week, I think.
And right. So,
yeah, I mean, I understand.
You weren't oblivious to the problem.
right. And, but yeah. I think there's different, this is a huge question, right? I mean, there's different components that we could break it out to. And I don't feel the necessity for me to be here right now. I think that it's very important. I still take a lot of time to make sure that I'm voting on things that I think matter at the higher policy level. I still try to talk and educate and work with my own community and family to talk through the things and the agency that they can take in the process. But I think we have to look at where resource distribution happens, right? And we're talking about really deep systemic problems that are ostensibly related to, I mean, deeper racism and cultural tension within our country. And people would have different arguments about that. But for instance, the disproportionality of funding, most research would show that to a certain extent, and you have to, there's a lot of caveats for the specificity of this, more funding doesn't equal a better education, right? There's a lot that goes into an education.
Sure.
So part of it is that it's not as simple as that. in the first place. And the second part of it is, look at the United States. It constitutes 6% of the world's population, consumes 42% of its resources per annum. There's just not, I mean, we have classrooms, we have 176 students to one teacher. It's not that I don't empathize with what's going on in the United States, but they're different problems. And I see more often than not, people are willing to kind of brush, you know, the African continent displacement, you know, hyper extreme poverty and conflict off to say, well, that's how Africa is. Mm. And that's not how it is. And that's not how it has to be.
And have you found that particularly, I mean, both of us have grown up predominantly in the post 9/11 era, but it strikes me that Africa as a continent and a concept kind of filled the Western public imagination in the 90s when perhaps the world was relatively peaceful otherwise. And then 9/11 happened, the Middle East kind of exploded in a storm of geopolitics, and the focus really shifted. And have you found that that's kind of even more of a reason for you to engage in that area? Has it made it more difficult to attract attention?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, we're all vying for news time, right? I mean, I think that's one of the challenges. And the thing that I'm at kind of odds with this. There's a good author, Jeffrey Gettleman, that writes a book called Love, Africa.
He was the New York Times foreign correspondent.
Exactly, yeah. And an interesting take, because he wrestles with this question on what do we give airtime in the world to an American audience or to a Western audience, because these are a lot of the influencers, and this, for people like myself and yourself, this is the question we're asking: how much of our airtime does it talk about? Because we have a lot of problems that we could be talking about, and for the time that we do get to talk about Africa, how many of these things are negative? These are big open questions, right? I mean, and so I even have a hard time with what stories do I choose to tell that are going to perpetuate stereotypes that happen maybe 1% of the time, but they happen 4 times as often as they would in the United States, right? Like, there's these big open questions on how we talk about them. And even in the Congo, I mean, since the year 2000, in Eastern Congo, there's been a confirmed conservative estimate of 2.3 million deaths as a result of conflict. We don't really talk about that. Right, like, so part of it is sure. That I think that this should be on the front lines of it, and it's hard to say, like, why is early grade literacy important to the average human being? I mean, in the system, I can talk about why that's important and why it underpins everything else.
But when you're fighting against the noise of a million other problems,
sure,
yeah. / existential crises that the world is facing, it's...
Well, right, and we're in a hot political time in our country right now, and that deserves a lot of attention because it has ramifications for a lot of people. So
sure.
It's just this balance, I think.
Sure. And we might sort of round out the interview with a bit of a lighter question or two. If none of this had ever happened and you'd sort of not dropped out of, was it Ohio State University?
Toledo University.
Toledo University.
The less cool Ohio school.
What do you think you'd be doing now? What's your best guess?
You know, at the time, I was most focused on running with a side ambition of Ultimate Frisbee, which is carried over.
carried over very strongly, I can vouch.
Still playing that. but, you know, I think I probably would have been a teacher. I probably would have been a coach. And probably in the state of Ohio. I mean, I would have had my credentials in that state. Probably would have been really bored looking at, you know, cornfields in that state. maybe more aggressively gotten involved in local politics. I mean, I think for...
pretty consistent with the spirit of what you have done, though.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. I mean, I think that's great. Because I think the point whenever we talk about these things is I try to be careful not to say, you should do what I'm doing. No, I mean, it's important. Mm-hmm. If this aligns with your values and you want to get involved, we'd love to have you. We'd also love your donation. You can do that at thiswebsite.com.
You can have your pitch here if you want to.
Oh, yeah, pangeaeducation.org. Check it out. But you know, the other side is also to say, I think each of our individual paths and ambitions are unique to us. So it's about us finding that. And it's equally as important to focus on the most minute thing in the corner of your local community as it is on the corner of a local community on another side of the world, right? So I think it just depends on who you are.
Sure. And if talent or skills or finances were no object, and I have a feeling you might have veered into this with the Ultimate Frisbee chat before, what do you think you would be doing?
Yeah, I'd definitely be a professional Ultimate Frisbee player.
Is there an American team?
There is. Oh, yeah, I'm the best in the world. Yeah, consistent.
Of course.
as we do. Biggest, best, whatever. I'd be doing exactly what I'm doing right now. I mean, would life be a little bit better if I would be able to more aggressively pay down my student loans and I don't know. Everyone could always.
You're literally living your best life.
Yeah, I feel like I'm busy.
Awesome. And you're still on the Harvard Varsity Frisbee team.
That's true.
So
that's true.
You're basically, you have it all.
Living the life right now, yeah. And I think the life will hopefully change, and we're trying to get better and do more. I mean, the thing that I would probably say is it would be great to have more money and a bigger budget so that we could do what we're doing at a little bit of a larger scale, but we're still learning how to manage the scale that we're working at now.
Yeah, sure. So it's just a constant learning curve upwards, I suppose. But it sounds like you guys are doing great things. So thanks so much for coming in today, Drew, and hanging out in this cool studio and chatting to everyone who's listening. Maybe we'll have you back on another time. So thanks a lot for coming in.
Thanks for having me. That'd be an honor.
We'll go to another tune, I think.
Nice. What's on the docket? What are we listening to this time?
Do you have any requests, Drew? This actually might be a moment, although I've put you on the spot. So
I mean, some Mumford & Sons would be...
Mumford & Sons, okay. Let's go. We'll just make sure we have a clean version of something. Any favorites, or do you want me to just go to town on my Spotify?
Go to town on your Spotify.
Okay. Here we go.
You know they're coming to town December 9th. Not to pitch their tickets for you. I'll be there at TD Garden. It's going to be wonderful.
There you go. There's another little spruik. Are you on commission from Mumford & Sons?
No, you know, the PSA's really got me going on the ad side of things here.
Here we go. Seems like we're having a few issues.
Is this the world telling us they just want to hear us talk more? I feel like we need to learn a little bit more.
Just throw on some chat. Throw around some chat while I try and get a song going.
I have a question for you. I mean, we didn't really know a whole lot about you, and this is the first time you're kind of running this show, this in your 20s. I mean, where did that inspiration kind of come from? Why do you want to do this?
Sure. Okay. I like this. Turn it on its head when Spotify fails us. I guess, so I've been working for the government for the last few years, and I've just moved over to Cambridge, actually, to pursue a master's in public policy. But I'm just a big podcast nerd, really, and I've always been really interested in media and the way media kind of plays a really important explanatory but also sort of persuasive role between the public and policymakers and politicians. So in a way, I'm just kind of interested in human motivation and kind of the collision of that with all these other broader issues. So I think that's why I wanted to start this show. With the added bonus that being in your 20s is just a really angsty time, and people are constantly asking you what you want to do with your life, and it's just really hard to know. And I think for a lot of us, we'll probably never know. So it's just a great opportunity to kind of hear from people about how they approach things and how they manage that angst, and I guess hopefully give other people both some comfort and some inspiration. So hopefully we can get a few more people on in the coming weeks who can kind of live up to the very interesting tone that you've set for the first episode.
Yeah, hopefully no one's snoozing. I mean, what are some of the topics? What's going to happen in 2 weeks? I mean, what do we have to look forward to?
2 weeks. Well, I'm not going to pretend that my advanced planning isn't great, but I think 2 weeks is still going to be a surprise. I have some personal topics that I'm particularly interested in hearing from people on. One of those is religion. I'm not a religious person. I come from a very secular country, and I'm really interested in America in particular on this front, because I think it's quite unusual in the developed world in terms of how religious it really is in a lot of different ways. So I'd really love to have someone on who is kind of willing to openly talk about whatever their religion is and how it kind of plays into their life. So I think that's going to be a priority for me. But really, I'm just trying to speak to as many people as I can while I'm here and get a sense of who might be interested in coming on and who might have an interesting story to tell. So
awesome.
We'll see how that goes in the coming weeks, and let's give this Mumford & Sons another crack.
promise you that I won't let you down. And I can't promise you that I will be the only one around when your hope falls down. But we are open flowers in the windy fields of this war-torn world. And lo, the city breathes the plague of loving things more than their creators. I ran away. I could not take the burden of both me and you. It was too far. Casting love on me as if it were a spell I could not break.
This is Izzy Borshoff, and you've been listening to 91.5 FM WMFO Medford.
Oh, what if I was wrong? But hold on to what you believe in the light when the darkness has robbed you of all your sight. Less and less to me without you breathing through its trees. At every turn, the water runs away from me and the halo disappears. I'm not whole and you're not near. So what if I was wrong? Oh, what if I was wrong? Oh, what if
dear friends.
You are now listening to great songs about nothing good.
Doctor,
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 doctor.
Doctor,
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 and doctor.
Whoa, we miss anyone?